Chapter 73 Hidden Rice. Late one afternoon, while sitting in meditation on Vulture Peak, the Buddha opened his eyes to see a man half concealed behind a nearby tree. The Buddha called to him. Beneath the bright moonlight, the man came forward, laid a sword at the Buddha's feet, and prostrated himself as if making an offering. The Buddha asked, "Who are you, and why have you come here?" The man exclaimed, "Allow me to bow before you, Teacher Gautama. I was ordered to come and kill you, but I cannot do it. I raised this sword in my two hands more than 10 times while you were meditating, but I was unable to take even one step toward you. I cannot kill you, but now I am afraid that my master will kill me. I was trying to decide what to do when you called to me. Allow me to bow before you." The Buddha asked, "Who gave you orders to come kill the Tathagata?" "I dare not tell you my master's name." "Very well. You need not tell me his name. But what did he tell you to do?"
"Master, he told me which path to climb up the mountain, and he showed me a different path to return by after completing my mission."
"Do you have a wife and children?"
"No, teacher, I am not yet married. I have only an aged mother."
"Then listen to me, and follow my instructions carefully. Return home at once, and escape tonight with your mother across the border into Kosala. You and your mother can find a new life there. Do not return by the road your master showed you. If you take that route, you are sure to be ambushed and killed yourself. Go now." The man prostrated himself once more and then hurriedly left, leaving the sword behind. The next morning, Venerable Sariputta and Moggallana came to speak with the Buddha. They said, "We believe it is time the two of us paid a visit to the other side. We want to help our brothers who, out of ignorance, have taken a wrong turn. We request your permission to be gone for a period of time." The Buddha looked at his two disciples and said, "Go if you feel you must, but take special care. Do all you can to protect your own lives." Just at that moment, Venerable Sariputta noticed the sword lying on the ground. He looked into the Buddha's eyes as if to question him. The Buddha nodded and said, "Yes, last night a soldier came here with orders to kill the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has offered him guidance instead. Leave the sword there. When Jivaka calls, I will ask him to dispose of it." Moggallana looked at Sariputta and said, "Perhaps it would be better not to leave the Buddha in such circumstances. What do you think, my brother?" Before Sariputta could respond, the Buddha said, "Do not worry. The Tathagata is capable of avoiding any dangers that arise." That afternoon, several bhikkhus from Bamboo Forest came to see the Buddha. They were so distraught they were unable to speak. Tears rolled down their cheeks. The Buddha asked them, "What is the matter? Why are you crying?" One bhikkhu wiped his tears and answered, "Lord, we have just come from Bamboo Forest. On the road we met brothers Sariputta and Moggallana. When we asked them where they were headed, they said they were crossing over to Gayasisa. We are so upset we cannot hold back our tears. More than 500 other bhikkhus have abandoned the Sangha, but we never expected your two most esteemed disciples to forsake you." The Buddha smiled and comforted the bhikkhus by saying, "Bhikkhus, do not grieve. The Tathagata trusts Sariputta and Moggallana. They will not betray the Sangha." The bhikkhus sat quietly at the Buddha's feet. The following day, Jivaka invited the Buddha for a meal offering at his mango grove. Venerable Ananda accompanied the Buddha. When they were finished eating, Jivaka informed them that Queen Videhi happened to be visiting. He wondered if the Buddha would mind meeting with her. The Buddha understood that Jivaka had secretly arranged this meeting to take place, and he asked Jivaka to summon the former queen. After she bowed to the Buddha, the queen began to sob. The Buddha let her ease her pain, and then he gently said, "Please tell me everything." The queen said, "Lord, King Bimbisara's life is in grave danger. Ajatasattu plans to starve him to death. He won't allow me to bring any more food to my husband." She told the Buddha that when the king had first been placed under house arrest, she had been allowed to bring him food each day. Then one day the guards confiscated the tray of food she was bringing to the king before allowing her to enter his chambers. She told the Buddha how, even though she wept, Bimbisara had consoled her and told her that he bore no hatred toward their son for his actions. He said he would rather suffer hunger than have the country plunged into war. The next morning the queen hid small rice balls in her hair while also carrying a platter of food.
The guards took away the platter, but the rice in her hair went undetected. She managed to feed her husband in such a manner for several days. But when the king did not die, Ajatasattu ordered the guards to more thoroughly search the queen. They discovered the hidden rice, and she was no longer able to bring him food that way. 3 days later, she devised another plan. She mixed a paste of milk, honey, and flour, which she spread over her body after bathing and drying herself. When the paste was dry, she put on her clothes. When the guards found no rice in her hair, they allowed her to enter the king's chamber. Once inside, she undressed and scraped off the paste to feed him. She had fed her husband twice now in this manner, but feared she would soon be discovered and forbidden to visit him at all. The former queen began to sob again. The Buddha sat silently. After a long moment, he asked about the king's state of health, both physical and spiritual. The queen said that although he had lost a lot of weight, his strength was holding up, and his spirit was most elevated. He expressed no feelings of hatred or regret. He continued to smile and carry on a conversation as if nothing had happened. He was using his time as a prisoner to practice meditation. There was a long corridor in his chamber where he did walking meditation. The room also had a window which faced Vulture Peak. He gazed at the mountain every day for long periods and did his sitting meditation at the same window. The Buddha asked the queen whether or not she had been able to send news to her brother, King Pasenadi. She replied that she had no means to do so. The Buddha said he would send a bhikkhu to Savatthi and ask King Pasenadi to help her any way he could. The queen thanked the Buddha. She then confided how before Prince Ajatasattu was born, the royal astrologers predicted he would betray his father. One day, during her pregnancy, she was suddenly seized with a bizarre urge to bite King Bimbisara's finger and suck his blood. She was frightened and shocked by her desire, unable to believe she could give rise to so terrible a thought. From the time she was a little girl, she had always been afraid of the sight of blood and could not even bear to watch a fish or chicken slaughtered. Yet on that day she desired nothing more than to taste her husband's blood. She struggled against her urge with all her strength until she finally burst into tears. Overcome with shame, she covered her face in her hands, but would not tell the king what was disturbing her. One day, not long after that, King Bimbisara accidentally cut his finger while peeling a piece of fruit. Unable to control herself, the queen grabbed his finger and sucked the drops of blood. The king was startled, but he did not stop her. Then the queen collapsed to the floor and sobbed. Alarmed, the king helped her up and asked her what the matter was. She told him of her strange and terrible desire. She told him how she had struggled against it, but had finally been defeated. She knew that the baby growing within her was the source of her violent urge. The royal astrologers suggested the baby be aborted or killed at birth. King Bimbisara could not agree to such a thing, and neither could the queen. When the prince was born, they named him Ajatasattu, which means the enemy not born. The Buddha advised the queen to visit her husband only once every 2 or 3 days to prevent arousing Ajatasattu's suspicions. She could spend a longer time with him on the days she did visit him. He also suggested that the king eat only a small amount of the nourishing paste at a time in order to save some for the days the queen did not visit. After offering these suggestions to the queen, the Buddha bid farewell to Jivaka and returned to Vulture Peak. Chapter 74. Cry of the Elephant Queen. Venerables Sariputta and Moggallana returned to Bamboo Forest after spending a little over a month at Gayasisa. The bhikkhus joyously welcomed them back. They asked the two venerables about the situation at Gayasisa, but Sariputta and Moggallana only smiled. A few days later, more than 300 bhikkhus from Devadatta's Sangha returned to Bamboo Forest. The bhikkhus at Bamboo Forest were overjoyed, and they greeted their Gayasisa brothers warmly. 4 days later, Venerable Sariputta took an exact count of the brothers who had returned from Gayasisa and learned there were 380 in all. He led them together with Venerable Moggallana to Vulture Peak to have an audience with the Buddha. As he stood outside his hut, the Buddha watched the bhikkhus being led up the mountain by his two senior disciples. Other bhikkhus who lived on Vulture Peak came out of their huts to greet the returning monks. Sariputta and Moggallana left the monks for a moment in order to speak privately with the Buddha. They bowed to the Buddha, who invited them to sit down. Venerable Sariputta smiled and said, "Lord Buddha, we have brought back nearly 400 bhikkhus." The Buddha said, "You have done well. But tell me, how were you able to open their eyes?" Venerable Moggallana explained, "Lord, when we first arrived, Brother Devadatta just finished eating and was preparing to give a Dharma talk. He looked very much as though he were trying to imitate you. When he looked up and saw us approaching, he appeared enormously pleased. He invited Sariputta to sit next to him on the Dharma platform. But Sariputta refused and chose to sit by one side instead. I sat on the other side." Devadatta then addressed the other bhikkhus. He said, "Today, Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Moggallana have joined us. They were my close friends in the past. Let me take this chance to invite Venerable Sariputta to give the Dharma talk today." Devadatta turned to Sariputta and joined his palms. "My brother accepted the invitation to speak. He spoke about the Four Noble Truths in a most beautiful way. All the bhikkhus listened as if spellbound. But I noticed Devadatta's eyes growing heavy, as if he wanted to fall asleep. No doubt he was tired from all his recent activities. Halfway through the Dharma talk, he was fast asleep. We stayed at Gayasisa for more than a month and participated in all the activities there. Every 3 days, Brother Sariputta gave a Dharma talk. He instructed the bhikkhus with all his heart. Once I noticed Bhikkhu Kokalita, Devadatta's chief advisor, whisper something to Devadatta, but Devadatta seemed to pay him little attention. I suspect Kokalita was warning him not to trust us. Devadatta, however, was glad to have someone assume responsibility for teaching the Dharma, especially when it was someone as capable as my brother Sariputta. One day, after delivering a discourse on the four establishments of mindfulness, Sariputta said, 'This afternoon my brother and I will be leaving you to return to the Buddha and the Sangha he leads. Dear brothers, there is only one fully enlightened master, and that is the teacher Gautama. The Buddha founded the Sangha of Bhikkhus. He is the source for all of us. I know that you would be warmly welcomed back by the Buddha if you returned. Dear brothers, there is nothing more painful than seeing a community divided. I have met only one true master in my life, and that is the Buddha. We will depart from you today, but should any of you decide to return to the Buddha, please come to Bamboo Forest. We will meet you there and take you to meet with the Buddha on Vulture Peak.' That day Devadatta was in the capital on business, but Venerable Kokalita, who had been hostile to us since our arrival, stood up to protest. He even hurled curses at us, but we simply stood up and pretended not to hear. We silently took our bowls and extra robes and left Gayasisa to return to Venuvana. We stayed in Venuvana for 5 days. 380 bhikkhus from Gayasisa followed shortly. The Venerable Sariputta asked, 'Lord, do these bhikkhus need to be reordained? If necessary, I will organize an ordination ceremony for them before they meet with you.' The Buddha said, 'That is not necessary, Sariputta. It will be adequate for them to make a confession before the community.' The two senior disciples bowed and rejoined the waiting bhikkhus. Over the next few days, 35 more bhikkhus left Gayasisa. Venerable Sariputta arranged a confession ceremony for them and then presented them to the Buddha. Venerable Ananda spoke to the 35 newest arrivals and asked them about the situation at Gayasisa. They told him that after Venerable Devadatta had returned from Rajagaha and learned that nearly 400 bhikkhus had abandoned him to return to the Buddha, his face turned scarlet in anger. He refused to speak to anyone for several days. Ananda asked, 'What did Brother Sariputta and Moggallana say to you that made you want to leave Brother Devadatta and return to the Buddha?' One of the bhikkhus answered, 'They never spoke a critical word against Venerable Devadatta or the Gayasisa Sangha. They simply taught the Dharma with all their hearts. Most of us have only been ordained 2 or 3 years and still lack stability and depth in our practice. When we heard Brother Sariputta's Dharma talks and received personal instruction from Brother Moggallana, we saw how marvelous and sublime the teaching of the Buddha truly is. The presence of Venerable Sariputta and Moggallana, with their profound understanding and virtue, was like the presence of the Buddha himself. We realized that although Venerable Devadatta speaks with great skill, he could not compare with them. After Venerable Sariputta and Moggallana departed, many of us discussed these things and reached the decision to return to the Buddha.
Ananda asked, "What did Bhikkhu Kokalita do when you left?"
"He was enraged. He cursed us, but that only made us all the more determined to leave."
One afternoon, as the Buddha stood on the mountain slope admiring the evening sky, he suddenly heard a shout from below.
"Watch out! Lord, a boulder is about to crash behind you!"
The Buddha looked back to see a boulder the size of a cattle cart crashing down the mountain toward him. It was difficult to move out of the way in time, as the mountain path was suddenly covered with sharp and jutting stones. By a stroke of luck, the boulder was blocked by two other rocks on the mountainside just before reaching the Buddha. But the impact of rock against rock sent a fragment flying, which pierced the Buddha's foot. Blood gushed from his wound and stained his robes. Looking up, the Buddha saw a man at the top of the mountain running quickly away. His wound was very painful. He folded his sanggati in four and placed it on the earth. He sat down on it in a lotus position and began to concentrate on his breath in order to calm the pain. Bhikkhus came running toward him. One exclaimed, "This is surely the work of Devadatta." Another said, "Brothers, let us divide ourselves into patrols to guard the mountain and protect the Lord Buddha. Let's not lose any time." Everyone ran about in circles, disturbing the previously calm evening. The Buddha said, "Brothers, please do not shout. Nothing warrants such noise. The Tathagata does not need to be guarded or protected. Please return to your huts. Ananda, send novice Kunda for physician Jivaka." They obeyed the Buddha's wishes. Jivaka came up to Vulture Peak in no time at all and asked that the Buddha be carried in a palanquin down to the mango grove. Within a few short days, people in the capital learned of the two attempts on the Buddha's life. They were shocked and dismayed. Not only that, but they received the announcement that King Bimbisara had died. Through unknown channels, the people learned how he died under house arrest. Agony filled the people's hearts. They looked toward Vulture Peak as a symbol of moral resistance. As they grieved for their king, their admiration for the Buddha deepened. Though the Buddha had chosen to remain silent about recent events, his silence had been well understood by the people. King Bimbisara was 67 years old when he died. He was 5 years younger than the Buddha. He had taken the three refuges with the Buddha when he was just 31 years old. Having ascended to the throne at the age of 15, he then reigned for 52 years. It was he who rebuilt the capital of Rajagaha after it had been destroyed by fire. Throughout the king's reign, Magadha had enjoyed continuous peace, with the exception of one short war with the kingdom of Anga. King Brahmadatta of Anga lost the war, and Anga temporarily fell under the jurisdiction of Magadha. When King Taxila Pukusati later assumed the throne in Anga, King Bimbisara maintained close and friendly relations with him to prevent future conflicts. Thanks to that, this new king also became a disciple of the Buddha. King Bimbisara had always understood the importance of maintaining good relations with neighboring kingdoms. He married Princess Kosala Devi, the younger sister of King Pasenadi of Kosala, and made her his queen. He also took wives from the Madra and Likavi dynasties. His elder sister was married to the king of Kosala. King Bimbisara showed his deep love and respect for the Buddha by having a stupa built in the royal gardens, which contained the Buddha's hair and fingernails. Incense and candles were regularly lit around the foot of the stupa to express gratitude for the Buddha's teaching. The king entrusted Srimati, a lady-in-waiting at the palace, with the stupa's upkeep. Srimati tended all the flowers and plants around the stupa and kept the area well swept. Just 10 days after the boulder was hurled at the Buddha, he and several bhikkhus were begging in the capital when Venerable Ananda looked up to see an elephant charging toward them. It appeared to have escaped from the royal stables. He recognized that it was the elephant named Nalagiri, infamous for its violent behavior. Ananda could not understand how the royal keeper could have allowed it to escape. Panic-stricken, people ran for cover. The elephant raised its trunk, lifted its tail and ears, and headed straight for the Buddha. Ananda grabbed the Buddha's arm to lead him to safety, but the Buddha would not budge. He stood calmly, unperturbed.
Some bhikkhus cowered behind him while others fled. People shouted at the Buddha to save himself. Ananda held his breath and stepped forward to place his body between the Buddha and Nalagiri. At that very moment, to Ananda's surprise, the Buddha let forth a majestic cry. It was the cry of the elephant queen the Buddha had befriended long ago in Rakita Forest and Parirajraka. Nalagiri was but a few yards from the Buddha when he heard the resounding cry, and he came to a sudden halt. The mighty elephant knelt on all fours and lowered his head to the ground as if to bow to the Buddha. The Buddha gently stroked Nalagiri's head, and then holding the elephant's trunk in one hand, led an obedient Nalagiri back to the royal stables. The people applauded and cheered. Ananda smiled. He thought back to the days when they were young. The young Siddhartha had known no equal in the martial arts. He excelled at everything: archery, weightlifting, swordsmanship, and horse racing. Today the Buddha treated an elephant on a rampage as though he were an old and docile friend. The bhikkhus and a large crowd followed the Buddha and the elephant back to the stables. When they arrived, the Buddha gave the keeper a stern look, but then spoke in a compassionate voice. "The Tathagata does not need to know who ordered you to release this elephant, but you should understand the seriousness of your action. Dozens, even hundreds of people could have been killed. You must never allow such a thing to happen again." The keeper bowed before the Buddha. The Buddha helped him back to his feet, and then joined the bhikkhus to resume begging. The Buddha and all his bhikkhus attended King Bimbisara's funeral. The ceremony was an event of great solemnity and beauty. The people grieved the passing of their beloved monarch and showed up in dense crowds to pay their final respects. More than 400 bhikkhus were present. When the funeral was over, the Buddha spent the night at Jivaka's mango grove before returning to Vulture Peak. The physician informed him that the former Queen Videhi had been forbidden to visit the king at all during the past month. The king passed from this life all alone. They found him lying down before his favorite window. His eyes were turned toward Vulture Peak when he took his last breath. Shortly after the king's funeral, Jivaka brought Prince Abhayaraja, son of King Bimbisara, and his wife Padmavati to see the Buddha. The prince requested to take vows as a bhikkhu. He told the Buddha that since his father's death, he had lost all enthusiasm for a life of wealth or fame. He had heard many of the Buddha's Dharma talks and felt drawn to the path of enlightenment. He desired nothing more than to lead the peaceful, unburdened life of a bhikkhu. The Buddha accepted Prince Abhayaraja into the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Chapter 75. Tears of Happiness. 10 days later, the Buddha put on his outer robe, took his begging bowl, and left the city of Rajagaha. He headed north across the Ganga, stopped along the way to visit Kutagara Monastery, and then made his way to Savatthi. It would soon be the rainy season again, and he needed to return to Jetavana to prepare for the annual retreat. Venerables Ananda, Sariputta, Moggallana, and 300 other bhikkhus accompanied him. When they reached Savatthi, the Buddha walked directly to Jetavana. Many bhikkhus and bhikkhunis had gathered to await his arrival. They had heard of events in Magadha and were relieved to see the Buddha unharmed and in good health. Bhikkhuni Kema was present. She now served as abbess to the bhikkhunis. King Pasenadi came to see the Buddha the moment he learned of his arrival. He asked the Buddha about the situation in Rajagaha and listened as the Buddha recounted everything, including his meeting with Queen Videhi, King Pasenadi's own sister. The Buddha told him that while she maintained a calm composure, he knew her heart was filled with grief and sorrow. King Pasenadi told the Buddha that he had already sent a delegation to Rajagaha to ask Ajatasattu, his nephew, to explain the imprisonment of King Bimbisara. A month had already passed, but no response had been received. King Pasenadi sent further word that if the new king deemed it necessary, he could come to Savatthi in person to explain the situation. King Pasenadi informed the Buddha that in order to demonstrate his opposition to the events in Magadha, he had reclaimed the territory he offered to Magadha many years ago on the occasion of his sister's marriage to King Bimbisara. This land was located close to the city of Varanasi in Kasi. The first day of the retreat season arrived. All the spiritual centers and monasteries in the region were filled to overflowing with bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. Every 10 days, the Buddha gave a Dharma talk at Jetavana to all the monks and nuns. These talks always took place following the noon meal. Monks and nuns who walked from the more distant centers did not have enough time to go begging if they wanted to arrive in time for the discourse. Lay disciples in the city worked hard to assure there was always enough food waiting for these monks and nuns. The first Dharma talk the Buddha delivered that season was on the subject of happiness. He told the assembly that happiness is real and can be realized in the very midst of daily life. First of all, the Buddha said, happiness is not the result of gratifying sense desires. Sense pleasures give the illusion of happiness, but in fact they are sources of suffering. It is like a leper who is forced to live alone in the forest. His flesh is racked by terrible pain day and night, so he digs a pit and makes a fierce fire, and he stands over it to seek temporary relief from his pain by toasting his limbs over the fire. It is the only way he can feel any comfort. But miraculously, after a few years, his disease goes into remission, and he is able to return to a normal life in the village. One day he enters the forest and sees a group of lepers toasting their limbs over hot flames just as he once did. He is filled with pity for them, for he knows that in his healthy state he could never bear to hold his limbs over such fierce flames. If someone tried to drag him over the fire, he would resist with all his might. He understands that what he once took to be a comfort is actually a source of pain to one who is healthy. The Buddha said, sense pleasures are like a pit of fire. They bring happiness only to those who are ill. A healthy person shuns the flames of sense desires. The Buddha explained that the source of true happiness is living in ease and freedom, fully experiencing the wonders of life. Happiness is being aware of what is going on in the present moment, free from both clinging and aversion. A happy person cherishes the wonders taking place in the present moment, a cool breeze, the morning sky, a golden flower, a violet bamboo tree, the smile of a child. A happy person can appreciate these things without being bound by them. Understanding all dharmas as impermanent and without a separate self, a happy person does not become consumed even by such pleasures. A happy person thus lives in ease, free from all worry and fear. Because he understands that a flower will soon wilt, he is not sad when it does. A happy person understands the nature of birth and death of all dharmas. His happiness is true happiness, and he does not even worry about or fear his own death. The Buddha told the assembly that some people believe it is necessary to suffer in the present in order to have happiness in the future. They make sacrifices and endure hardships of body and mind, thinking they can acquire happiness in the future. But life exists only in the present moment. That kind of sacrifice is a waste of life. Other people think that if you want peace, joy, and liberation in the future, you must practice self-mortification in the present. They practice austerities, starve themselves, and inflict pain on their minds and bodies. The Buddha taught that such practices cause suffering for the person in both the present and the future. Still others contend that because life is so fleeting, they should not concern themselves with the future at all. They may try to satisfy all their sense desires in the present. The Buddha explained that clinging to sense pleasures this way causes suffering in both the present and the future. The path the Buddha taught avoided both extremes. He taught that the most intelligent way is to live in a way that fosters happiness for both the present and the future. The way of liberation does not force austerities on the body in the hope of attaining future happiness. A bhikkhu creates happiness for himself and for all those around him in the present moment by the way in which he eats his daily meal, meditates, and practices the four establishments of mindfulness, the four limitless meditations, and the full awareness of breathing. Eating only one meal a day keeps his body healthy and light and allows more time for spiritual practice. Living in ease and freedom, he is better able to help others. Bhikkhus remain celibate and childless, not as a practice of austerity, but as a means of being more free to help others. the bhikkhu is able to see the happiness that is present in each moment of daily life. If he feels his chastity deprives him of happiness, he is not living the spirit of the teaching. A bhikkhu who follows the teaching of celibacy according to its true spirit radiates ease, peace, and joy. Such a life brings happiness in both the present and future. After the Dharma talk, lay disciple Punalakana asked the Buddha if she could speak to him. She told the Buddha that her husband, Sudatta Anathapindika, had fallen gravely ill. He was in such great pain he was unable to attend the Dharma talk. His condition was steadily worsening. He feared he would die before having a chance to see the Buddha one last time. The next day, the Buddha, together with Venerable Sariputta and Ananda, went to visit Sudatta. Sudatta was deeply moved to see them. His face was pale and drawn, and he could barely sit up. The Buddha said to him, "Sudatta, your entire life has been filled with meaning and happiness. You have relieved the suffering of countless others, moving the people to bestow upon you the name of Anathapindika, the one who cares for the poor and abandoned. Jetavana Monastery is one of your many fine accomplishments. You have constantly contributed to efforts to spread the Dharma. You have lived according to the teaching, and have thus created true happiness for yourself, your family, and many others. You can rest now. I will ask Venerable Sariputta to visit you often and provide you special guidance. Don't try to come to the monastery. You should reserve your strength." Sudatta joined his palms in gratitude. 15 days later, the Buddha gave a Dharma talk on lay life. He told the laity how they could realize true happiness in their daily lives. He reviewed the principle of living for peace in the present, peace for the future, which he had presented in his previous Dharma talk to the monks and nuns. He also said, "A bhikkhu lives a celibate life in order to enjoy peace and joy in the present moment. Such a life assures future happiness as well. But homeless bhikkhus are not the only ones who can enjoy such happiness. Lay disciples living in the world can follow the principles of the teaching to foster true happiness. First of all, do not let a desire for wealth cause you to become so consumed by your work that you prevent happiness for yourself and your family in the present moment. Happiness is foremost. A look filled with understanding, an accepting smile, a loving word, a meal shared in warmth and awareness are the things that create happiness in the present moment. By nourishing awareness in the present moment, you can avoid causing suffering to yourself and those around you. The way you look at others, your smile, and your small acts of caring can create happiness. True happiness does not depend on wealth or fame." The Buddha recalled a conversation he had had with a merchant named Sigala several years previously in Rajagaha. One morning, the Buddha left Bamboo Forest with his begging bowl just as daylight was breaking. He came upon a young man on a path just outside the city. Sigala was bowing to the 6 directions of east, west, south, north, down, and up. The Buddha stopped and asked him the purpose of his bowing. Sigala said his father had taught him as a child to bow to the 6 directions every morning. He liked to obey his father's wishes, but he did not actually know the purpose for the ritual. The Buddha told him, "Bowing is a practice that can foster happiness for both the present and the future." He told Sigala that as he bowed to the east, he could contemplate gratitude to his parents. When he bowed to the south, he could contemplate gratitude to his teachers. Bowing west, he could contemplate love for his wife and children. Bowing to the north, he could contemplate love for his friends. Bowing down, he could contemplate gratitude to his co-workers. Bowing up, he could contemplate gratitude to all wise and virtuous persons. The Buddha taught Sigala the 5 precepts and how to look deeply at things in order to avoid acting out of greed, anger, passion, or fear. The Buddha told Sigala to avoid the 6 actions that lead to ruin: abusing alcohol, wandering through city streets late at night, frequenting places of gambling, visiting places of depravity, loitering with persons of poor character, and succumbing to laziness. In addition, he told Sigala how to determine who was worthy of being considered a good friend. He said, "A good friend is constant, whether you are rich or poor, happy or sad, successful or unsuccessful. A good friend is one whose feelings for you do not waver. A good friend listens to you and shares your sufferings. He shares his own joys and sorrows with you, while regarding your joys and sorrows as his own. The Buddha continued his Dharma talk by saying, "True happiness can be realized in this very life, especially when you observe the following. 1. Foster relations with people of virtue and avoid the path of degradation. 2. Live in an environment that is conducive to spiritual practice and builds good character. 3. Foster opportunities to learn more about the Dharma, the precepts, and your own trade in greater depth. 4. Take the time to care well for your parents, spouse, and children. 5. Share time, resources, and happiness with others. 6. Foster opportunities to cultivate virtue. Avoid alcohol and gambling. 7. Cultivate humility, gratitude, and simple living. 8. Seek opportunities to be close to bhikkhus in order to study the way. 9. Live a life based on the Four Noble Truths. 10. Learn how to meditate in order to release sorrows and anxieties." The Buddha praised lay disciples who lived the teaching in their daily lives within their families and society. He made special mention of Suddhata Anathapindika. He said that Suddhata was an exemplar of one who devoted all his efforts to creating a life full of meaning, service, and happiness. Suddhata's heart was truly deep. His entire life had been guided by the teaching. The Buddha said that people who owned far greater wealth than Suddhata would not find it easy to match the happiness he had created for others. Suddhata's wife, Punalakana, was moved to tears by the Buddha's praise of her husband. She stood up and respectfully addressed the Buddha. "Lord, a wealthy person's life is often very busy, especially when he owns many things. I think that maintaining a small and modest vocation would be more conducive to spiritual practice. When we see the bhikkhus, free of home and family, who own little more than a bowl, we long for a more simple, carefree life ourselves. We would like to live a leisurely life too, but we are bound by so many responsibilities. What can we do?" The Buddha answered, "Punalakana, bhikkhus have responsibilities too. A celibate life requires a bhikkhu to live mindfully by the precepts day and night. A bhikkhu devotes his life to others. Lay disciples, the Tathagata wishes to suggest a way by which you can taste the life of a bhikkhu twice a month or so. We shall call this practice the 8 observances for the laity. Twice a month, you can come to the temple and follow these practices for a day and a night. Like the bhikkhus, you will eat only one meal. You can practice sitting and walking meditation. For 24 hours, you can enjoy a celibate, aware, concentrated, relaxed, peaceful, and joyous life as if you were a monk or nun. When the day is over, you can return to your secular life, observing the 5 precepts and 3 refuges as usual. Lay disciples, the Tathagata will inform the bhikkhus about the 8 observances for the laity. These special days of practice can be observed at temples or even in your own homes. You can invite bhikkhus to your homes to administer the 8 observances and to offer teaching on your day of practice." Punalakana was pleased with the Buddha's suggestion. She asked, "Please, Lord, what are the 8 observances?" The Buddha answered, "Do not kill, do not steal, do not engage in sexual activity, do not lie, do not use alcohol, do not adorn yourself with jewelry, do not sit or lie on a fancy bed, and do not use money. These 8 observances can prevent forgetfulness and confusion. Eating only one meal on your day of practice will allow more time for your practice." The people were happy with the Buddha's suggestion for special days of practice for the laity. 10 days later, a servant from Suddhata's household came to inform Venerable Sariputta that Suddhata's illness had taken a turn for the worse. Sariputta asked Ananda to join him, and together they walked into the city. They found Suddhata lying on his bed. A servant pulled 2 chairs close to the bed for the bhikkhus. Knowing that Suddhata was suffering greatly in his body, Venerable Sariputta advised him to practice contemplating on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha to ease the pain. "Lay disciple Suddhata, let us contemplate together on the Buddha, the Enlightened One, on the Dharma, the way of understanding and love, and on the Sangha, the noble community that lives in harmony and awareness. Knowing that Suddhata did not have much longer to live, Venerable Sariputta told him, "Lay disciple Suddhata, let us contemplate as follows. My eyes are not me, my ears are not me, my nose, my tongue, my body, and my mind are not me." Suddhata followed Sariputta's instructions. Then Sariputta continued, "Now let us continue to contemplate. That which I see is not me. That which I hear is not me. That which I smell, taste, touch, and think are not me." Sariputta then showed Suddhata how to contemplate on the six sense consciousnesses. Seeing is not me. Hearing is not me. Smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking are not me. Sariputta continued, "The element earth is not me. The elements water, fire, air, space, and consciousness are not me. I am not bound or restrained by the elements. Birth and death cannot touch me. I smile because I have never been born and I will never die. Birth does not give me existence. Death does not take existence away." Suddenly, Suddhata began to weep. Startled to see tears roll down the lay disciple's cheeks, Ananda asked him, "Are you upset, Suddhata, because you are unable to follow the contemplation?" Suddhata answered, "Venerable Ananda, I am not upset at all. I am able to follow the contemplation without difficulty. I weep because I am so deeply moved. For more than 30 years I have had the honor of serving the Buddha and the bhikkhus, but I have never heard a more sublime and profound teaching than this teaching today." Ananda said, "Suddhata, the Lord Buddha frequently offers this kind of teaching to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. Venerable Ananda, lay disciples are also able to understand and practice such a teaching. Please ask Lord Buddha to share this teaching with the laity." Suddhata died later that day. Venerables Sariputta and Ananda remained with him and continued to recite sutras over his body. Anathapindika's family was a model for all other families. All the members of his family took refuge in the Buddha and devoted themselves to studying and applying the Dharma in their daily lives. A few days before his death, Suddhata learned that his youngest daughter, Sumagada, was sharing the teaching with people in Anga. She had married a man from Anga who was a governor and a devout follower of the unclothed ascetics. When he asked her to visit the ascetics with him, she diplomatically declined. Over time, her solid understanding of the Buddha's way touched her husband and opened the hearts of many people in their region. Chapter 76. The Fruits of Practice. Just as the retreat season was ending, the Sangha learned that war had broken out between Kosala and Mogoda. Mogoda's army, led by King Ajatasattu Vidahiputta himself, had crossed over the Ganga into Kasi, a region under Kosala's jurisdiction. The king and his generals led an enormous battalion of elephants, horses, carts, artillery, and soldiers. Because it all happened so quickly, King Pasenadi was unable to inform the Buddha of his departure to Kasi. He asked Prince Jetta to explain the situation in his place. The Buddha already knew that after King Pasenadi learned how Ajatasattu killed his own father to usurp the throne, King Pasenadi showed his opposition by reclaiming a district near Varamasi he had formerly presented to King Bimbisara. For nearly 70 years, this district had brought in revenues of over 100,000 gold pieces to Magadha, and King Ajatasattu was not about to give it up. So he called his soldiers into battle. Venerable Sariputta instructed all the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis to remain in Savatthi. It was too dangerous to travel with a war raging. He also asked the Buddha to remain in Savatthi until peace was restored. 2 months later, the people of Savatthi received the disheartening news that their army had suffered defeat in Kasi. King Pasenadi and his generals were forced to retreat back to the capital. The situation was fraught with tension. But thanks to a strong system of defense, Savatthi did not fall, even though Ajatasattu's generals attacked day and night. Then, thanks to a brilliant plan devised by General Bandula, King Pasenadi was able to mount a major counteroffensive. This time Kosala scored the decisive victory. King Ajatasattu and all his generals were captured alive. More than 1,000 soldiers were taken prisoner. Another 1,000 had either been killed or fled. In addition, Kosala confiscated large numbers of elephants, horses, army carts, and supplies of artillery. The war had raged for more than 6 months. The people of Savatthi organized a victory celebration. After dismantling his army, King Pasenadi visited the Buddha at Jetavana. He described the terrible cost of the war and said that Kosala had acted in self-defense when King Ajatasattu attacked their borders. He added that he believed King Ajatasattu had been wrongly influenced by his advisors. "Lord Buddha, the king of Magadha is my own nephew. I cannot kill him, nor do I have any desire to put him in prison. Please help me find a wise course of action." The Buddha said, "Your Majesty, you are surrounded by loyal friends and aides. It is no surprise that you came out the victor in this war. King Ajatasattu is surrounded by bad elements, and so he has gone astray. The Tathagata suggests you treat him with all respect due a king of Magadha. Take time, as well, to guide him as your own nephew. Strongly impress on him the importance of surrounding himself with friends and aides of good and loyal character. Then you can send him back to Magadha with proper ceremony. The possibility of lasting peace depends on your skill in handling these matters." The Buddha called for a young bhikkhu named Silavat and introduced him to King Pasenadi. Bhikkhu Silavat was originally a prince, one of King Bimbisara's sons, and King Ajatasattu's half-brother. Silavat was a wise and bright man who had studied the Dharma as a lay disciple under the guidance of Venerable Moggallana from the age of 16. After the changes that took place in Magadha, he asked Moggallana to allow him to be ordained, and he was sent to Jetavana and Savatthi to further his studies. Venerable Moggallana knew that although Silavat harbored no desire for the throne, it would nonetheless be safer for him to be out of King Ajatasattu's jealous reach. King Pasenadi asked the young bhikkhu to describe the situation in Rajagaha. Silavat told the king all he had seen and heard before he left Magadha. He also informed the king that someone had been sent from Magadha to try and kill him, but he had been able to effect a change of heart in the assassin. That man was now an ordained bhikkhu himself, living in a center close to the capital. King Pasenadi bowed to the Buddha and returned to his palace. Shortly afterward, King Ajatasattu was released and allowed to return to Magadha. Using love to ease the wounds of hatred, King Pasenadi gave his own daughter, Princess Vajira, in marriage to Ajatasattu. Ajatasattu was now his son-in-law as well as his nephew. King Pasenadi also promised to return the district to Varanasi as a wedding gift. King Pasenadi had wholeheartedly followed the spirit of the Buddha's counsel. With the war over, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis once again took to the road to spread the teaching. King Pasenadi ordered the construction of a new monastery on the outskirts of the capital and named it Rajakarama. The Buddha remained in Kosala for the following 2 years, passing the retreat seasons at Jetavana and the rest of the time teaching throughout the region. From time to time, he received news from Magadha from bhikkhus who had come from there. They told him that after the Buddha left Magadha, Venerable Devadatta ceased to enjoy the good graces of King Ajatasattu. Of the more than 100 bhikkhus still with Devadatta at that time, 80 had returned to the Buddha's Sangha at Bamboo Forest. Devadatta was more and more isolated. He had recently fallen ill and was unable to leave Gayasisa. Since the end of the war, King Ajatasattu had not paid him even one visit. King Ajatasattu did not pay any visits to Bamboo Forest either. He only maintained relations with leaders of other religious sects. Nevertheless, the Sangha continued to spread the Dharma unimpeded. The laity and bhikkhus in Magadha hoped that the Buddha would return to visit them. Vulture Peak and Bamboo Forest seemed empty without him. Jivaka awaited his return as well. That winter, Queen Malika of Kosala died. Deeply grieved, King Pasenadi came to the Buddha for comfort. The queen had been his closest friend, and he loved her with all his heart. She was a faithful disciple of the Buddha, a radiant spirit who understood the deeper reaches of the Dharma. Even before the king met the Buddha, the queen had shared her understanding of the way with him. The king recalled how one night he had a disturbing dream, which he feared was a warning that misfortune would befall him. Placing his faith in the Brahmins, he asked them to sacrifice several animals in order to ask the gods for protection. The queen dissuaded him from doing so. She had often served as a close advisor to the king on political matters, helping him find solutions to problems that beset the country. She was one of the Buddha's most devoted lay disciples. Because she loved to study the Dharma, she built a Dharma discussion hall in a park with many beautiful tinduka trees. She often invited the Buddha and his senior disciples to give Dharma discourses and lead discussions there. She also opened the hall to leaders of other religious sects to use. Suffering from the loss of his companion for more than 40 years, the king came to the Buddha. As he sat quietly next to the Buddha, he felt peace slowly return to his heart. He had been following the Buddha's suggestion to spend more time meditating. The Buddha reminded him of their previous conversation, in which they discussed the importance of living according to the teaching in order to create happiness for those around one. The Buddha encouraged the king to reform the system of justice and economics in the country. He said corporal punishment, torture, imprisonment, and execution were not effective means for stopping crime. Crime and violence were the natural result of hunger and poverty. The best way to assist the people and provide for their security was to concentrate on building a healthy economy. It was essential to provide food, seeds, and fertilizer to poor farmers until they could become self-sufficient and productive. Loans should be provided to small merchants. Retirement funds should be set up for those no longer able to work, and the poor should be exempted from taxes. All manner of coercion and oppression against manual laborers must cease. People should be free to select their own jobs. Ample opportunities for training should be made available to help people master the trades they chose. The Buddha said that a correct economic policy should be based on voluntary participation. Venerable Ananda was sitting close to the Buddha during this conversation with the king. He was thus able to preserve the Buddha's ideas on politics and economics in the Kutadanta Sutra. Late one afternoon, Ananda found the Buddha sitting outside the Visakha Dharma Hall. His back was turned to the sun. Ananda found it curious. The Buddha was usually fond of watching the sun set. He asked the Buddha about it, and the Buddha replied that he was letting the sun warm his back. Ananda approached and began to massage the Buddha's back. He knelt down to massage his legs as well. As he massaged the Buddha's legs, he remarked, "Lord, I have been your attendant for the past 15 years. I remember how firm your skin was in the past, and how it had such a healthy glow. But now your skin is wrinkled, and your leg muscles have grown soft. Why, I can count all your bones." The Buddha laughed. "If you live long enough, you grow old, Ananda. But my eyes and ears are as sharp as ever. Ananda, do you miss Vulture Peak and the groves at Bamboo Forest? Wouldn't you like to climb to Vulture Peak again and watch the sun set? Lord, if you would like to return to Vulture Peak, please let me accompany you." That summer, the Buddha returned to Mokata. He walked leisurely, breaking the long trek into several short trips. He stopped all along the way to visit Sangha centers. He taught the bhikkhus at each center and delivered talks to the laity. He passed through the kingdoms of Sakya, Mala, Videha, and Vaji, before he at last crossed the Ganga into Magadha. Before going onto Rajagaha, he stopped to visit the Sangha center in Alanda. Bamboo Forest and Vulture Peak were as beautiful as ever. People from the capital and neighboring villages came to see the Buddha in droves. Nearly a month passed before the Buddha was free to accept Jivaka's invitation to his mango grove. Jivaka had built a new Dharma hall in the grove that was large enough to seat 1,000 bhikkhus. While they sat outside his hut at the mango grove, the Buddha listened to Jivaka recount events that had taken place in the Buddha's absence. Queen Videhi, he was pleased to learn, had found inner peace. She devoted time to meditation and had become a vegetarian. King Ajatasattu, on the other hand, was suffering from extreme mental anguish. He was haunted by his father's death, and his mind could find no ease. His nerves were constantly on edge, and he was afraid to sleep at night because of the terrible nightmares he suffered. Many doctors and high-ranking priests from the sects of Makali Gosala, Ajita Kosakambali, Pakuda Kakayana, Niganta Nataputta, and Sanjaya Belatiputta had been summoned to try to cure him. Each priest, hoped to effect a cure so that their particular sect would receive special patronage, but not one of them was able to help the king. One day the king ate dinner with his wife, their son Udaibada, and his mother, the former Queen Videhi. Prince Udaibada was almost 3 years old. Because the king catered to his son's every whim, the prince was an unruly and spoiled child. The prince demanded his dog be allowed to sit at the table with them. Though such a thing was normally forbidden, the king gave in to his son's wish. Feeling somewhat embarrassed, he said to his mother, "It is unpleasant having a dog sitting at the table, isn't it? But what else can I do?" Queen Videhi answered, "You love your son, and so you have allowed him to bring his dog to the table. There is nothing unusual about that. Do you remember how your own father once swallowed pus from your hand because he loved you?" Ajatasattu did not recall the incident and asked his mother to tell him what had happened. The queen said, "One day your finger became red and swollen. A boil formed underneath your fingernail. It caused you so much pain. You cried and fretted all day and night. Your father was unable to sleep out of concern for you. He lifted you onto his pillow and placed your infected finger in his mouth. He sucked on it to help relieve the pain. He sucked on your finger throughout 4 days and nights until the boil broke. He then sucked out the pus. He did not dare remove your finger from his mouth to spit out the pus for fear you would feel more pain. And so he swallowed the pus while continuing to suck on your finger. From this story, you can see how deeply your father loved you. You love your own son, and that is why you have allowed him to bring his dog to the table. I can understand that very well." The king suddenly clutched his head in his two hands and ran from the room, leaving his meal uneaten. After that night, his mental state worsened. At last, Jivaka was summoned to take a look at the king. Jivaka listened to Ajatasattu recount all his woes and how no priest or Brahmin had been able to help him. Jivaka sat without saying a word. The king asked, "Jivaka, why don't you say anything?" Jivaka responded, "There is only one thing to tell you. Teacher Gautama is the only person who can help you overcome the agony in your heart. Go to the Buddha for guidance." The king did not speak for several minutes. Finally, he muttered, "But I am sure Teacher Gautama hates me." Jivaka disagreed. "Don't say such a thing. Teacher Gautama does not hate anyone. He was your father's teacher and closest friend. Going to him will be like going to your own father. See him and you will find inner peace. You will be able to restore all you have torn asunder. My ability to heal is not worth anything compared with the Buddha's ability to heal. He is not a medical physician, but he is the king of all physicians. Some people call him the medicine king." The king agreed to think about it. The Buddha remained at Vulture Peak for several months. He visited the Sangha centers in the region and also agreed to spend a month at Jivaka's mango grove. It was there that Jivaka arranged for King Ajatasattu to meet with the Buddha. On a moonlit night, the king, seated on an elephant, proceeded to the grove accompanied by the royal family, his concubines, palace guards, and Queen Videhi. When they entered the grove, all was still. The king was seized with sudden panic. Jivaka had told him that the Buddha was dwelling in the grove with 1,000 bhikkhus. If that was true, how could it be so quiet? Could it be a trick? Was Jivaka leading him to be ambushed? He turned to Jivaka and asked if this was all a plot in order for Jivaka to seek revenge. Jivaka laughed out loud. He pointed to the Dharma hall from which light was streaming through a round window. Jivaka said, "The Buddha and all the bhikkhus are in there this very moment." The king climbed down from his elephant and entered the hall, followed by his family in attendance. Jivaka pointed to a man sitting on a platform, his back supported against a pillar, and said, "There is the Buddha." The king was deeply impressed by the attentive quiet. 1,000 bhikkhus surrounded the Buddha in perfect silence. Not even a robe rustled. King Ajatasattu had only seen the Buddha a few times in his life, and he had never joined his father in attending the Buddha's regular Dharma talks. The Buddha invited the king and royal family to be seated. The king bowed and then spoke, "Lord, I remember hearing you speak at the palace when I was a young boy. Tonight I would like to ask you a question. What kinds of fruit does the spiritual life bear that hundreds, even thousands, abandon their homes to pursue it. The Buddha asked the king if he had ever asked any other teacher the same question. The king responded that he had, in fact, asked dozens of other teachers, including Venerable Devadatta, but he had never received a satisfactory answer. The Buddha said, "Your Majesty, tonight the Tathagata will tell you the fruits that can be found in this teaching, fruits that can be enjoyed in this very moment, and fruits that can be reaped in the future. You need not seek lofty answers. Simply look and see these fruits as clearly as a mango held in your own hand. Your Majesty, consider this example. A servant caters to all his master's whims and commands from sunup to sundown, until one day he asks himself, 'As my master and I are both human beings, why should I allow myself to be abused by him?' The servant decides to leave his life as a servant to enter the homeless life of a bhikkhu. He pursues a chaste, diligent, and mindful life. He eats but one meal a day, practices sitting and walking meditation, and expresses calm dignity in all his movements. He becomes a respected, virtuous monk. Knowing that he was formerly a servant, if you met him, would you call out to him and say, 'Here, fellow, I want you to serve me from sunup to sundown. Obey all my commands.' The king said, 'No, Lord, I would not address him in such a way. I would respectfully greet him. I would make food offerings to him and assure that he received the full protection of the law afforded to monks.' The Buddha said, 'Your Majesty, that is the first fruit a bhikkhu reaps. He is liberated from racial, social, and caste prejudice. His human dignity is restored.' The king said, 'Wonderful, Lord, please tell me more.' The Buddha continued, 'Your Majesty, dignity is only the first fruit. A bhikkhu observes 250 precepts, which enable him to dwell in calm peace. People who do not observe precepts are more easily misguided. They may commit such crimes as lying, drunkenness, sexual misconduct, stealing, and even murder. They bring cruel punishment on their minds and bodies by acting this way. They may be arrested and put in jail by the police and government officials. A bhikkhu observes the precepts of not killing, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, not lying, and not using alcohol. In addition, he observes more than 200 other precepts, which assure him a carefree life unknown to those who do not observe precepts. Precepts help prevent one from falling into error, thus assuring a carefree state. That is another fruit of spiritual practice, which can be enjoyed right in the present moment.' The king said, 'Wonderful, Lord, please tell me more.' The Buddha continued, 'Your Majesty, a bhikkhu owns no more than 3 robes and a begging bowl. He has no fear of losing his possessions or being robbed. He knows he will not be attacked in the night by people who want to steal his wealth. He is free to sleep alone in the forest beneath a tree, relaxed and without worries. Freedom from fear is a great happiness. That is another fruit of spiritual practice, which can be enjoyed right in the present moment.' The king trembled, and he said, 'Wonderful, Lord, please tell me more.' The Buddha continued, 'Your Majesty, a bhikkhu lives simply. Though he eats only one meal a day, his bowl receives offerings from 1,000 different homes. He does not chase after wealth or fame. He uses only what he needs and remains unattached to desires. Living in such carefree ease is a great happiness. That is another fruit of spiritual practice, which can be enjoyed right in the present moment.' The king said, 'Wonderful, Lord, please tell me more.' The Buddha continued, 'Your Majesty, if you knew how to practice full awareness of breathing and how to meditate, you could experience the happiness of one who follows the path. It is the happiness that meditation brings. A bhikkhu observes the 6 sense organs and overcomes the 5 obstacles of the mind, which are greed, hatred, ignorance, torpor, and doubt. He uses the full awareness of breathing to create joy and happiness that nourish his mind and body and help him to make progress on the path of enlightenment. The pleasant sensations that result from gratifying sense desires are no measure for the joy and happiness that meditation brings. The joy and happiness of meditation permeates mind and body, heals all anxiety, sorrow, and despair, and enables the practitioner to experience the wonders of life. Your Majesty, that is one of the most important fruits of spiritual practice, and one that can be enjoyed right in the present moment. The king said, "Wonderful lord, please tell me more." The Buddha continued, "Your majesty, thanks to dwelling diligently in mindfulness and observing the precepts, the bhikkhu is able to build concentration, which he can use to illuminate all dharmas. Thanks to his penetrating illumination, he sees the selfless and impermanent nature of all dharmas. Thanks to seeing the selfless and impermanent nature of all dharmas, he is no longer entangled by any dharma. He can thus cut through the ropes of bondage that bind most people, the ropes of greed, hatred, desire, laziness, doubt, false view of self, extreme views, wrong views, distorted views, and views advocating unnecessary prohibitions. Cutting through all these ropes, the bhikkhu attains liberation and true freedom. Your Majesty, liberation is a great happiness and one of the greatest fruits of spiritual practice. There are bhikkhus sitting here tonight who have attained that fruit. This fruit, Your Majesty, can be attained right here in this life." The king exclaimed, "Wonderful Lord, please tell me more." The Buddha continued, "Your Majesty, thanks to illuminating and seeing deeply into the nature of all dharmas, a bhikkhu knows that all dharmas are neither produced nor destroyed, neither defiled nor immaculate, neither increasing nor decreasing, neither one nor many, neither coming nor going. Thanks to this understanding, a bhikkhu does not discriminate. He regards all dharmas with complete equanimity, without fear or worry. He rides the waves of birth and death in order to save all beings. He shows all beings the way so they too can taste liberation, joy, and happiness. Your Majesty, being able to help others free themselves from the maze of desire, hatred, and ignorance is a great happiness. Such happiness is a sublime fruit of spiritual practice, which begins to be realized in the present and extends to the future. Your Majesty, in all of his contacts, a bhikkhu remembers his responsibility to guide others on the path of virtue and liberation. Bhikkhus do not engage in partisan politics, but they contribute to building peace, joy, and virtue in society. The fruits of his spiritual practice are not for the bhikkhu's sole enjoyment and benefit. They are the people's and country's inheritance." The king stood up and joined his palms in deepest respect. He said, "Most sublime teacher, Lord, by the use of simple words, you have shown me the light. You have helped me see the true value of the Dharma. Lord, you have rebuilt that which was in ruins, revealed that which was concealed, shown the way to one who was lost, and brought light into the darkness. Please, Lord, accept me as your disciple, as you accepted my parents in the past." The king prostrated himself before the Buddha. The Buddha nodded his acceptance. He asked Venerable Sariputta to teach the three refuges to the king and queen. After they recited them, the king said, "As it is late, please allow us to return to the palace. I have an early morning audience." The Buddha nodded again. The encounter between the Buddha and King Ajatasattu benefited all those present. The king's mental torment rapidly improved. That same night he dreamed he saw his father smiling at him, and he felt that all that had been torn asunder was now made whole again. The king's heart was transformed, bringing great joy to all his people. After that, the king visited the Buddha often on his own. He no longer came on an elephant accompanied by royal guards. He climbed the stone steps carved into the mountain, just as his father, King Bimbisara, had done so often in the past. In his private meetings with the Buddha, King Ajatasattu was able to reveal his heart and confess his past crimes. The Buddha treated him as though he were his own son. He counseled the king to surround himself with men of virtue. At the end of the retreat season, Jivaka asked the Buddha to allow him to enter the homeless life as a bhikkhu. The Buddha accepted him and gave him the Dharma name of Vimalakondana. Bhikkhu Vimalakondana was permitted to continue to stay at the mango grove. There were about 200 bhikkhus already in residence there. This was the place at which the Buddha was cared for following the accident on Vulture Peak. With so many mature mango trees, the Mango Grove Monastery was a very pleasant place to stay. Bhikkhu Vimalakondana continued to grow medicinal herbs for the community of bhikkhus.